Into the Weird, Episode 17, Nazi Stein.
Welcome to Into the Weird, a podcast celebrating the madness and magnificence of the mighty Marvel Bronze Age. I'm your host, Billy D, and alongside me is my co-host, the curator of the Long Box of Darkness, Herman Lowe. How are you, Herman?
Hi, Billy. Glad to be back. I hope everything's okay in your neck of the woods. Over here, it's pretty cold, but nothing compared to what's happening in the States, I guess.
Yeah, the last couple of nights were around 10 degrees Fahrenheit. So I'm not sure what the conversion is to Celsius, but I know it's quite a little bit below zero there. So yeah, it's been a little chilly.
Damn, a little chilly? Well, I mean, here it's chillier than usual, but when I say chilly, I mean like 10 degrees Celsius. So, you know, I can't complain compared to what you guys are experiencing. But yeah, it's been a while since we've recorded. Again, our listeners are probably used to the shtick by now. But the reason for that is I went traveling a bit. We went to see some family up in Australia, in Brisbane, for three weeks, and my parents went over there, so it was a nice time. So a bit of a family reunion.
Yeah, that's always good to hear, family stuff. Family is important. That's number one, so that's great to hear.
That's right. But, you know, luckily we managed to release that, you know, Weird Wacky Villains episode, the one that we called the Revisited episode, just before I left. So we got something, at least, you know, on the a docket for this year. But right now we're back to our usual schedule, listener, so you can expect some more consistent episodes from now on, I hope.
Yeah, we figure the last couple months of the year were rough. You had a move, and then the holidays, so it was, and then you went on vacation the holiday there. So yeah, we had about a lot going on. November and December were tough months, but we're back in the saddle.
Yeah. This year, you and I have both decided we're going to make it a more reliable show to listen to. You know, so maybe even two episodes, maybe more per month. So look forward to that, listeners. But Billy, we've got a very interesting issue that we're going to discuss today, because this is our first foray into the past. Now, listeners might be thinking, what the heck are we talking about? We always talk about comics from the past, the Bronze Age. No. We're talking about a comic here that's set in the past of the past, which is basically Roy Thomas's love child. And the comic we're referencing here is The Invaders from the 1970s. So, Billy, what's your history with The Invaders, the title that Marvel published from 1975 onwards, featuring the Golden Age timely comics Marvel heroes?
Well, I didn't, when I first heard about The Invaders, I think it was in Marvel 2-in-1 maybe or something like that. It wasn't the actual title itself. It was like a more ancillary title. And I didn't understand that it was, you know, like you said, a title that came out in the mid-1970s, but was basically, you know, a bit of a retcon as far as, you know, stories that happened during World War II when you had, you know, Cap and Subby and Torch and all those guys. But once I got into it, oh, I love it. I probably have only have about 2/3 of the series, and I'm working on finishing it off, but I love it. I think it's great. I love period pieces. I love, you know, stories based in, you know, wars and stuff like that. I think they're always very interesting, and you can't ask for somebody better than Roy Thomas. I mean, he did it at Marvel, and then he did it again at DC.
Yeah, with All-Star Squadron, you're right. I mean, yep. Roy Thomas is very vocal about his love for the Golden Age, and particularly the superheroes that fought in World War II. You know, so when he was growing up, he was born in 1940. Roy was obviously reading, you know, when 1950 came around, or even earlier, he must have been reading a lot of the old comics, the back issues that he must have found, or, you know, did they even have places where you could get back issues? I'm not sure. But, you know, I'm not sure where he got all of his Golden Age comics from. But, you know, the war comic genre had already fallen out of favor, I think, by the 1950s, you know, because of people were just tired of war after World War II. They didn't want to read about it anymore. So he must have read a lot of old comics, you know, just written or said during the war. And that's where his love for, you know, the timely characters. And even, of course, DC. He was primarily a DC Comics fan, or National Comics, as they were known then. That's why he applied, you know, as a writer at DC initially. And then, you know, Mort Weisinger treated him so badly that he jumped ship to Marvel literally within the span of a day, right? So we all know that story. But he loved the DC Golden Age characters. But then, of course, he's also a fan of the timely characters of Marvel. We're talking here about the original Human Torch, a Submariner, and, of course, Captain America. So, you know, and of course you had Bucky and Toro along for the ride. Bucky, Cap's sidekick, Toro, the Torch's sidekick. And, you know, I find that team compelling. But, yeah, Roy basically had his cake and ate it because, you know, during that time, Billy, I think it was 1975, that was the time of the giant-sized issues. Do you remember giant-sized X-Men? 1975, yeah. I mean, revitalized the X-Men, introduced some new mutants, and that's where we got Nightcrawler, Colossus, Storm, Wolverine. And then, but at the same time, you know, this is lesser well-known because it's overshadowed by the success of the X-Men. At the same time as the release of Giant Size X-Men number one, they also released the Invaders, Giant Size Invaders number one. And that was basically Stan Lee saying, Roy, do anything you want. You know, do something that you've always wanted to do. And I think before that, Roy was already like working on the idea for the Liberty Legion. You know, he did want to do a kind of a comic set in World War II for Marvel. But for some reason after that, the Liberty Legion was introduced later. Roy decided he was going to go for the Invaders. Like you say, he was going to relaunch the Invaders or revamp the team. But basically, it's the same team as, well, they weren't really a team back in, you know, the 1940s when Timely was still publishing them, right, Billy? They were just thrown together, you know, in comic books. They weren't called, I think, formally the Invaders. They might have been, you know, but it wasn't. There wasn't a comic book titled The Invaders back then. You know, it was just their separate comics coming together, I think, in All Winners comics and stuff like that, where they teamed up.
Yeah.
And basically sowed the seeds for the genesis of the Marvel Universe, where everybody interacts with everybody else. So, you know, Roy, you know, definitely got this project going. You know, he's wanted to do this for a while. And then the art was done by Frank Robbins, whom I love, you know, because I'm a Morbius fan, you know, from Adventures into Fear, that era. Frank Robbins did a lot of the art on Morbius at that time. But, you know, I first encountered this comic much later. I didn't have it as a kid. It wasn't in the long box my uncle gifted me. I didn't buy it off the stands. I think possibly the first time I picked up a couple of back issues was in the early 1990s. You know, so this was one of the Bronze Age titles I didn't read when I was a kid, you know, in the late 70s and early 80s. I just don't know why it wasn't around. So, yeah, I picked up a couple of back issues. But this issue in particular, Billy, that we're talking about, can you tell the readers a little bit about this issue? I mean, you picked it. So I want to know. Obviously, when the readers hear, you know, what it's about, they will know why you picked it, because this is definitely you. there's some character in here that we both love. But what can you tell us about the issue in general?
Yeah, I mean, from the front cover, you know exactly what's going on. It's the invaders, and then meet Frankenstein! Exclamation point.
That explains everything, really.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, the cover itself, this is, readers, to give you a bit more info, this is particularly the Invaders issue 31.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is, you know, in the time when there weren't, you know, long story arcs, readers didn't have to worry about getting caught up on everything. Basically, they tell you everything you need to know from the very beginning. You know, you have obviously the core cast of Cap, the Human Torch, and Submariner, which you can see on the cover and on the corner box. But then you also have other characters that you know, find in the pages of the comic, like Spitfire or Union Jack. And like I mentioned, the sidekicks. But, you know, this is the Invaders issue 31. And, you know, basically the cover is what drew us to this comic, if I'm correct in saying that, right, Billy?
Because absolutely.
It features the Frankenstein monster. Yeah. So what do you think of this cover?
Well, the first time I saw this cover, I thought, wow, this is a really cool cover. But I actually didn't realize who the artist was, because I didn't see a signature anywhere, and I wasn't, you know, I'm still not the greatest at seeing covers and knowing, being able to recognize the artist's work. I mean, Kirby, you know, people like that, or John Buscema, some of those guys I can recognize. But this one always intrigued me, because I thought, well, who did this cover? Because, you know, there's no credit on the inside or anything like that. And figure pre-internet days, it was always like, blew my mind, like, who did this cover? And then, you know, eventually I found out, oh, it was done by Joe Sinnott, you know, the longtime Kirby inker on FF.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a great job. I mean, this to me proves that he wasn't just an inker, he was an artist.
Yeah, that's right. And to take that a little further, Billy, I mean, the pencils, the interiors are even done by Chick Stone, another inker of Kirby's. And obviously proving that he's quite a good artist as well. Now, I don't like him as much as I like Frank Robbins's art, but he's pretty good. He's pretty close. I mean, this story is very serviceable, even though it doesn't feature amazing art. It works for me. It gives you that kind of Frank Robbins feel, but also reminiscent of the old Kirby art featured in the 1940s. I mean, anyone who picks up a Captain America Masterworks or Golden Age Masterworks from those early, you know, 1940s issues, where you see Kirby, you know, penciling Cap. This is reminiscent of that, I think. Or what do you think?
Yeah, for sure. Mm. Yeah, for sure. I mean, like you said, I think Chick Stone, I don't know how much actual penciling he did, but, you know, this is, like you said, it's serviceable. It's not, you know, the greatest comic book I've ever seen, but it's pretty good stuff. You know, I'll give him credit. It's good stuff.
But on the wacky meter, Billy, this is definitely at least a 9 out of 10. Man, this story, that's why you picked it. And that's why I okayed it, because it is definitely a step or a leap into the weird.
Yeah, for sure.
So to give the listeners a little bit more in-depth data, the title of the story is Heil Frankenstein. So that already goes into weird land. And then writer Don Glute, I'll speak more about him later, penciler Chick Stone, inker Bill Black, letter Tom Orkowski, colorist George Roussos. And for the listeners who want to find this, you can or read this particular issue, it is on Marvel Unlimited. And you can also find it in the Invaders Classic, Volume 3 trade paperback. And then it's also in Volume 2 of The Collected Invaders, which was released a couple of years ago. There's two volumes featuring the entire series of 40-plus issues. So, but I've got the original issue here. It's a bit, you know, like I bought it in the early 1990s, a little bit battered. But I prefer reading it like that, because it's just more authentic feel to it. And then, of course, the editor was Roy Thomas. Now, Roy was writing the series on and off at this point in time. He was writing it way more consistently during the first year or two, but you know, this was just him editing it, but you can still feel Roy Thomas's influence here.
Yeah.
Very similar to earlier stories. And then, Billy, I'm going to leave it to you to give the listeners a quick synopsis. Now, this is going to be a very quick synopsis because this story is, like you mentioned off mic earlier, Billy, it's very simplistic, but so much fun. So take it away.
All right. So the scene opens with a panel showing Spitfire as she finds an enormous Nazi hat and remarks that it wouldn't fit anyone. But then Cap recalls a story before Spitfire and Union Jack joined the team, where the invaders traveled to the Swiss Alps and had to face down the Frankenstein monster. Upon entering the castle, the monster slaps both Cap and Bucky silly, and then both and the torch are prisoners of the mad Dr. Frankenstein. And then after that, we'll just get right on into it. Because it was a very straightforward story. This could almost be like, you know, you feel like a Sunday strip with this one.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, there's so much to unpack here, Billy, because, okay, first we have to mention, okay, let's, before we get in depth into the events which you set the stage for, without dropping any spoilers right at the beginning, the cover we need to talk a little bit more about. I mean, Joe Sinner did an amazing job. This Frankenstein monster is similar to the one introduced in Monster of Frankenstein in the Marvel comics at this point in time, but it's not the same monster. He just looks similar. This is basically another monster that was came after, you know, in terms of the timeline, but it's got nothing to do with the actual Monster Frankenstein, which was running around the Marvel horrorverse at the time. And the image of seeing the Frankenstein monster in a Nazi uniform, though, that is so upsetting to me. And not just because I hate Nazis. I mean, it as a superhero, seeing a Frankenstein monster dressed in a Nazi uniform, you must feel some trepidation, right, Billy?
I mean, you're already seeing a monster. And then a monster wearing a Nazi uniform is pretty wild. But yeah, like you said, it's like to set the stage. What they did is it's a descendant, you know, of Victor Frankenstein makes another patchwork monster to carry out his terror.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it does follow along some of the tropes, like, you know, there's the pitchfork and torch wielding villagers that want to burn the place down and kill everybody. But like we said, it's just, you know, you throw in the whole Nazi angle from World War II here, and that's a good wrinkle in this for sure.
That's right. Now, the cover has the Frankenstein monster just slapping Cap.
You know? Pimp slapping him.
And it seems like he's also, you know, including Namor in that slap. And, you know, then you've got the torch blasting away, missing completely. And there's like a suit of armor in the bottom left of the cover. Mm-hmm. And then in the background, this I find fascinating. Just check out Billy. In the background, there's a doorway, a stairs leading up to a doorway where you see some futuristic machines in a laboratory. And look how well Joe Sinner drew those machines. I mean, those machines are great. I mean, that would even give Kirby a run for his money.
Yeah, for sure. He did this. It's an excellent cover. I don't know how you would even pick this cover apart at all. It's right up. It's 10 out of 10 cover. You can't get better than this.
Basically, the whole story is compressed in this cover.
Pretty much, yeah.
And they've even got a bit of a they point towards one of their horror titles, which is being released at the same time concurrently, Monsters Unleashed. And they, you know, on the blurb on the cover, they say Cap, Namor and the Torch battle a monster unleashed, and they've got it written in the same little font, monster font, as the title Monsters Unleashed, the magazine title at the time. So a great cover, right, Billy? Lots of action in there. And then, you know, to fill in what you've already mentioned, this story obviously is not set in the normal theater of war. It's in fact set in Switzerland, which was a neutral country in World War II. But that's an apt setting because the original Frankenstein story written by Mary Shelley, it did in fact take place in Geneva, Switzerland. I mean, if you take into account that Dr. Victor Frankenstein went to study in Germany, and that's where he actually created the Frankenstein monster during his studies, you know, in Germany. And then, you know, he went back to Geneva, and then the monster followed him and then wreaked all kinds of havoc on his family. So this is set in Switzerland, and a descendant of Dr. Victor Frankenstein, Dr. Basil Frankenstein, right? He's the guy perpetrating this evil on this small Swiss village, where his castle looms over. Now, this is presumably the original abode of Victor Frankenstein, which in the novel was a country estate, but here it's a castle much similar to Dracula's.
Yeah.
And it overlooks this village, which is a classic setting for, you know, kind of like the Hammer movies that we so love, right, Billy? Dracula's mm-hmm. castle is, or yep. Frankenstein, well, not Frankenstein in the Hammer universe, he just had a normal home. But here it's definitely like the Hammer Dracula movies, where the castle is sort of ominously in the background all the time, and the villagers look up to it and fear it and want to burn it down. So, wow, this is the stuff we love.
Mm-hmm.
But this Dr. Basil Frankenstein, he basically became a Nazi because he says that his experiments offended the scientific community, and the only people who would allow, you know, his experimentation or grave robbing or recreation of human life to continue were the Nazis. Obviously, the Nazis being evil, you know,
yeah.
People like Dr. Mengele, you know, doing experiments on prisoners,
mm-hmm.
and you know, camp victims. You'd expect this from a Nazi, right? The Nazis would allow a guy like Dr. Basil Frankenstein to just run rampant among the graves of Europe and mm-hmm. stitch people together. Now, it's not just the Nazis, right, Billy? I mean, Basil Frankenstein, he's got a sidekick, or mm. actually a co-conspirator. Can you tell us a little bit about this feisty female?
Yeah, it's a woman, actually, an Asian woman named Dr. Kitagawa. And Basil Frankenstein explains to Cap, who's, you know, stunned to see an Asian woman there, that, you know, he can't use, you know, he's in a wheelchair, this Basil Frankenstein. And he's like, is he all like a quadriplegic or basically a paraplegic?
Yeah.
And he said his hands aren't really working very well anymore. So this doctor from Japan, who, you know, of course, was, you know, part of the World War II there, the
Axis powers, yeah.
The Axis powers, yeah. So she's there, and she's basically his hands for surgery and all that.
Yeah, she's an accomplished surgeon, right? That's what they mentioned.
Yep.
Yeah. So,
mm-hmm.
He even calls her Kitty.
Yeah.
I mean, Dr. Kitagawa. Yeah. So obviously, the use of a nickname for her means that, you know, there's something going on between them. And later we do learn that, well, Dr. Kitagawa, she says they've fallen in love during their time mm-hmm. researching, you know, how to stitch the dead back together.
Yeah.
But then she sort of falls for Cap.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite panels.
Oh, man. Okay, well, let's slowly lead up to that, Billy, because that's ridiculous, you know, that scene. So you've got a lot of cool tropes here. You've got, you know, dead people being, you know, their bodies being harvested to create this Frankenstein monster, and mm-hmm. Terrorizing the villagers just as a sort of a prototype. You know, basically this Dr. Basil Frankenstein is sending out this Frankenstein monster that he's created to basically terrorize the villagers just to test if it would make a good Nazi field, you know, infantryman.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, the Torch and Toro, they investigate and they disappear. So Cap and Namor and Bucky head to Switzerland, get this, in Namor's supersonic Atlantean flagship. They fly across the Atlantic. They fly across, you know, we presume they fly from England, right? That's where their base is.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
They fly across the Atlantic.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. To the Swiss Alps. And then they land in this village, and they land in the midst of a mob ready to go and burn down the castle. And at first, this mob with the pitchforks and everything and torches, they want to attack Cap and Bucky because they look so strange. They're dressed in weird clothes. They call them demons. And then, you know, to make the matter even worse, Namor shows up, and who looks more than a demon than him? I mean, the funny thing is the villagers, when they see Namor, they say, another strange one. Look at his feet and look at his ears. I'm just surprised nobody said, look at his strangely shaped head. Nobody said that. But Namor's ready to throw down. He's ready to pummel these villagers. And then Cap stops that by saying something crazy. Cap's basically using his fame to quell this mob. He's saying, whoa there, you know, I can't believe that, you know, this village, that even though it's so far behind the times, you've never heard of Captain America. And then one of the villagers says, oh, Captain America. Oh, yes, I see your uniform now in the moonlight. And then Namor's not ready to let it go. He's ready to like tear into these people. He even takes like, they call his flagship Weird, which it is. The flagship is damn weird. It looks like a flying what fish or something, right?
Yeah.
So the villagers comment on the look of the flagship, and Namor's like, how dare you insult the imperial flagship of Atlantis?
Which is bizarre in itself. Like, why does an Atlantean need a ship to fly around the planet when, you know, he can swim from here to there, and all he cares about is his undersea kingdom? But anyway.
Yeah. Well, you'd think Namor could, you know, since he's fighting the war, he would utilize some of that super science of Atlantis to help the allies, but he doesn't. Only this flagship. But you know, it gets really crazy from there, Billy. Now, then we learn from the villagers as they're talking to Cap. This is a bit of exposition here, but it's illustrated as well, the events that unfold.
Yeah.
At first, the villagers discover the empty graves of their loved ones, and then they recount the two flying beings that suddenly flew over their village, which was obviously
demons
in their minds. Yeah, so, you know, based on the fact that they saw these demons, and then a couple of days later, a giant monster murdered some of them, right? Basically tore through the village in a bloody rampage. The villagers have had enough. And they're grabbing their pitchforks, their axes, their torches. And then, just as they were about to storm the castle, this weird flagship of Namor arrives. And that's where, you know, Cap and them meet them. But then, Billy, what do you make of the exchange Cap and Bucky has, you know, when they talk to the villagers about it's something out of a horror movie?
Yeah, you figure out the universals were out by now, so
yeah, they were, but the villagers, obviously being, you know, backward savages as they're described here, which is not true. This is not what Switzerland was like. You know, people were, you know in Switzerland. Even the small villages read newspapers. They knew what was going on in the world. But these villagers, they don't even know what is a horror movie.
Yeah.
Now, it might be that they don't know English, you know, but I know Cap's fluent in German and French, you know, that's been established. So,
right,
whatever language they're speaking in, they must know what Cap is referring to. So this is the case of, you know, the Marvel Universe, cinematic universe Cap never getting the modern references Tony Stark and the guys are throwing around. And then he does get the reference of the flying monkeys, you know, in the first Avengers movie, because Wizard of Oz. This is now Cap throwing out a reference, and the other party are not getting it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So this guy says, you know, Cap says, it's like something out of a horror movie. And the villagers they don't know what Cap's talking about. And then, you know, they keep discussing this Baron Frankenstein, and Cap manages to talk down the villagers and persuade them that they will go in and see what's happening. And for some reason, Namor hangs back, right? I don't know exactly why, but Cap and Bucky, maybe you'd think that Namor would be less inconspicuous than them, because Cap and Bucky, they're not dressed for, you know, for sneaking up. They're brightly colored, red and blue, and I don't know what they're doing. But anyway, they sneak into the castle. And then you've got this great bit of dialogue from these German soldiers. Now, this is Don Glute, the writer, writing a German accent, and this is brilliant. They round this corner, and these Nazi flags are everywhere in this castle, and these Nazi soldiers spot them. And the one guy says, "Und now der Führer's greatest enemies will die. Shoot them." Wow. And then Cap and Bucky just tear into these Nazis, which is what we want to see in an Invaders comic, right, Billy?
And then they give them all the normal ratsies, goose steppers, they call them everything Routes. Under the sun. Yep.
Oh, that's brilliant. But then, you know, just as they've you know, smacked down all of these goose steppers, like you say, they encounter the Frankenstein monster. And this is where the tide of battle turns. I mean, he just basically slaps Bucky and Cap around. And then during the fight, Dr. Basil Frankenstein appears with Dr. Kitagawa pushing him around in his wheelchair. And then the nefarious plot of, the plot I think cooked up by Dr. Kitagawa is revealed to us. She wants to, since she's in love with Basil Frankenstein, she wants to find a body, a young, attractive body, according to her, right? That she could use to actually transplant Dr. Basil Frankenstein's brain into, because his body is ruined because of a lab accident. She's in love with him, but their love has only been intellectual, in her words, right? Uh-huh. So now she wants to go for the physical. Yeah, but you know, it doesn't just end there, right, Billy? Like, after the Frankenstein monster single-handedly captures Bucky and Cap and drags them away by their necks and puts them in this prison cell, they discover Toro there, and he's being drenched by chemicals, which stops him from flaming on. And then there's a bizarre panel where the Frankenstein monster just comes into the cell and he says, "Sieg Heil." And then Cap thinks, "Ye gods." Whoa. Now that is cool. And then we learn what Kitty's got planned for Cap, you know. Basically, I jumped the gun in discussing what she wants to do. But other than the usual, scheme of turning dead Nazi soldiers into Frankenstein-like monsters to win the war, they've also got, you know, this plan of transplanting Basil's brain into Cap's body, because Dr. Kitagawa, she's got Cap on this table, and she says, "As for your participation in working together, Basil and I have fallen in love. But due to Basil's paralysis, our love has been intellectual. You attract me, Yankee." And then she gives him a kiss. She gives him a kiss on the cheek. And the expression on Cap's face is like, wow, this is the vilest thing. Smack, that's the sound effect.
And there's Basil lurking in the background watching her kiss him. It looks kind of creepy.
Dude, that is sick. He's like enjoying this. He's like, "Oh, show me what you're going to do to me, Kitty, once I'm in that body."
Yeah, she says, "You'll attract me more once your skull houses Basil's superb brain."
Oh, man. This is where, listeners, where the bizarre nature of this comic comes to light and why we picked it. And then they discover the human torch in this bubble, in this glass dome. And apparently this glass dome serves to leech the torch's android energies from his body and transfers it into the Frankenstein monster's body. And that is to make him grow. So essentially to make him more powerful. But Dr. Basil Frankenstein literally mentions that he wants the Frankenstein monster to be bigger. He wants him to reach the size of the original Frankenstein monster, which his ancestor created. So, you know, for him, size is everything. I'm sure he won't be disappointed once he's in Cap's body. And neither will Kitty. So, but then, you know, when this machine is activated, this glow surrounds the castle, and the villagers have had enough. They've had enough. They've decided, okay, this is it. They're going to burn down the place. Namor can't stop them. So presumably Billy Namor was left behind to control the villagers.
Yeah.
But
he was the crowd control.
Yeah.
Poor the subby. Deterrent.
Because obviously these villagers are going to be killed if they approach these Nazis, you know, who are, you know, wielding these submachine guns. But Namor decides, okay, he can't stop the villagers because he might injure them with his hybrid strength. And then those are his words, listeners. And then Namor mm-hmm. decides the best bet is to just fly ahead of them and reach the castle before they do. And mm-hmm. that's when Namor, you know, arrives in the proverbial nick of time, just to, you know, in time to see the Frankenstein monster grow from the torch's energies. And then Namor, you know, he basically... Okay, but there's this great line, Billy, about when the villagers arrive at the castle and this Nazi soldier. You want to take it? Just tell
them. No. You do a better German accent than me. So here's the villagers, and then you take over when it's the Nazi soldier. So the villager, Dr. Frankenstein shall not unleash another monster on our village. Let's kill the doctor and burn his castle to the ground. Then the Nazi soldier comes in and says,
Herr Doctor, there is a verdammt mob outside, threatening to break inside.
And Basil says,
No, not now.
If they burst in here before the experiment is completed, it could prove disastrous. Butcher them.
Butcher them?
Butcher them.
Holy crap.
Wow, that's harsh, man. That is really harsh. And then Namor says, I've seen enough. And he rips out this antenna from the roof, mm-hmm. hurls it through a skylight, like a spear thrower, and then frees the torch, and then everything goes to hell. Basically, that's it. The Nazis now are, you know, routed. The villagers prove to be quite good at pugilism, right? They're basically slapping these Nazis around, punching them. You know, why don't the Nazis just unload their machine guns on them? I don't know why, but so the villagers do. I mean, Cap even comments on that. Or no, it's Namor. He says, wow, the villagers are doing quite well for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then Torch frees Cap and all four of the, yeah, Bucky included, or five. Mm-hmm. Yeah, five invaders gang up on the Frankenstein monster and they proceed to knock him into these machines. I mean, it's Namor who lands the final blow, which sort of sets the Frankenstein monster free, right, Billy? It turns out that those machines were pivotal in mind-controlling him.
Yeah.
Yeah, so basically with the machines destroyed, he's set free and he's none too pleased, much like the original Frankenstein monster was with his creator. This Frankenstein monster views his life as an abomination he doesn't want to be alive in this misshapen patchwork form. So, but this takes a very strange turn, right, Billy? He literally, he picks up Dr. Basil Frankenstein and Dr. Kitagawa, like two kids, and holds them under his arms and runs up the stairs with them, knocking Cap out of the way. And he runs to the parapets of the castle. And then, you know, one side of the castle looks down into this crevice, this, you know, well, it's on this cliff in any case. So it's a very, very great height. And then he jumps with them. He plunges with them. And he even gets his voice in the end. He says there, mm-hmm. you know, Dr. Basil Frankenstein appeals to him, says, don't kill us. We gave you life. The Frankenstein monster, you want to go for him, Billy.
Yes, Frankenstein, a life of misery, a body from the stolen remains of friends. But now I shall return to the graves that spawned me, and you, my two creators, will join me. And he swan dives off of the castle.
Yeah, and then they plummet to their doom. And, you know, now it turns out the villagers have butchered the Nazi soldiers, because do you see the one villager that observes the dead bodies of that comes upon the dead bodies of the Frankenstein monster, Dr. Basil and Kitty? He says, Frankenstein and his demon as dead as the soldiers.
Yeah, and the idiot has an axe in his hand, yes, but the blade facing his face.
Yeah, exactly. Why was he planning on shaving? Jeez. Oh, but that part's great. It's brilliant. Yeah. And then, you know, the story concludes with the torch sort of doing something really bizarre. He saves the castle from being burned, being, you know, destroyed by these villagers by saying that, you know, no, in the memory of the artificial man who died here, you will not burn down this castle. It should stand as a memento to his passing, because after all, I am a synthetic as well. Something like that, right?
Yeah.
And so then,
yeah, he's like, he's more human than I.
And he threatens to burn the village, the villagers. He burn down the village if they burn down the castle. And then Cap concludes the story very abruptly in a single final panel saying, thus, Castle Frankenstein is still standing.
And Spitfire says, but does the torch really protect it? Have you asked him? And Cap just goes, would you?
What? What? That part's jarring. Don Glute, I don't know what he was doing there, but very funny. And then, I loved it, Billy. This was a great issue. I don't know about you, but well picked. Definitely well picked.
Yeah, it's one of those issues where, what is it? I think the story is only 17 pages, which usually you'd have a backup or something, but this book just has a plethora of ads to get to the, 22 pages or whatever. But it's a quick read, but it's fun. It's a blast to read. This is one I can pick up anytime and read it and sit here and laugh.
Yeah, so much fun. This is actually, a story set in the Invaders' past.
Mm-hmm.
Because, Spitfire and Union Jack are not featured. But the fact that Don Glute picked this story to be told in the way of Cap telling it to Spitfire after she found the Nazi hat that was worn by the Frankenstein monster. That is insane. I don't even know why. She stumbles upon this hat, and then that leads Cap into this tale of the Frankenstein monster. But it's great.
Story time with Uncle Cap,
That's right. So, Billy, we'll get right into our Bronze Age Brilliance and Mighty Marvel missteps here. I'm going to let you go first. What was your Bronze Age Brilliance for this issue?
Okay, for me, there's a couple of things. The dialogue, especially for like Basil Frankenstein and Kitty calling Cap Yankee hero. And it's just when he says to the Nazi soldiers, butcher them. When the villagers are trying to come in the house, like that dialogue is just, it's hokey, but it's funny. I like it. I get a kick out of that. And then I just love the tropes. You're probably going to talk about it a little bit here, with Don Glute. He's a big horror fanatic. He's actually even made, small, short horror movies. Yeah. So like the tropes of the villagers and the castle and all that kind of stuff is great. I love that kind of stuff. I eat it up, even in a story that's not so great, I'll still read a story and enjoy a story that has those kind of tropes in it. That stuff, like you said, you and I especially being big Hammer fans and, even Universal, like we enjoy that kind of stuff. So
that's right.
That stuff to me is just brilliant. I love it.
Yeah, well, that kind of gels with what, I'm picking as Bronze Age Brilliance as well. I'm not picking the writing specifically. I'm just picking Don Glute, the man, as the Bronze Age Brilliance here, because, it's not just his writing style. It's also the, tropes and the genre he's playing in. This definitely plays to his strengths because, like you say, he's a horror fan. And, in the 1950s, he had a very interesting life, this guy, Don Glute. He was a filmmaker, like you mentioned. He made 41 amateur films, most of them in the horror vein. And that was, in the 1950s and 60s and later in his life, too. That's probably his complete tally for the 1950s and 60s. And then he started writing screenplays and he started writing comics. And he created a lot of comics for Gold Key, right, Billy? The Occult Files of Dr. Spectre, he wrote Dagar the Invincible, Trag and the Sky Gods. Mm-hmm. And then, he went over to Creepy and Eerie and he wrote for Vampirella.
Yeah.
And for Marvel, he wrote What If, he wrote Solomon Kane, Invaders, Kull. He had some Kull stories, Captain America, Star Wars. So, he was all over the place. And then, obviously, if you look at his bibliography, he wrote a lot of books about horror. He was not just a comic book writer and screenwriter. He also wrote nonfiction, but about monsters and monster movies. He wrote the Dracula book. Published in the 1970s. He wrote The Frankenstein Legend, a tribute to Mary Shelley and Boris Karloff.
Yeah.
He wrote lots of stuff about, true werewolves of history, true vampires of history, all of this kind of stuff. So he definitely a horror fan first and foremost. And that's my Bronze Age Brilliance, is them getting this guy to play in this genre in the 1940s in an Invaders comic. And I loved it. Everything, like you mentioned, the evil scientist, the lab, the brain transplant, the villagers, the mob, the grave robbing. There's so many horror tropes packed into this comic. Yeah, so that's my Bronze Age brilliance. Don Glut, the man.
Yep. Yeah, he's very much, you know, a historian and a fan of horror himself. So you really saw that, you know, coming out in this issue.
Yeah, that's true. So, Billy, what about your Mighty Marvel missteps?
Okay, so there wasn't anything that I thought was too awful here, but just a couple of things that bothered me. The first thing was when Cap sees the Franken Nazi come in and say, "Sieg Heil," and he says, "Ye gods!" That's just bizarre. He sounds like Thor. Like, I don't know where he got that dialogue from. That's just really weird. And then at the very end, the torch stopping the villagers from burning down the castle, that just makes absolutely no sense. You know, I don't know why that got included in this, but that just makes no sense. He's going to not let them destroy the castle because he's not, you know, fully human, and neither was Frankenstein. Like, they're both artificial. What does that have to do with the castle? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense at all.
I know what you mean. That's weird. Yeah. That's really strange. But I agree with you that for me, you know, some plot parts of the plot did not gel quite as well. You know, for instance, Namor staying behind. Do you think the invaders would let their most powerful member lead the charge? You know, but obviously the villagers were a threat, but they could have even utilized the villagers to an extent without still placing them in danger. But leaving Namor behind to pick up the slack later on, it's strange. And then other things too, like the way that I mentioned earlier, the way that Don Glut chose to tell the story with Spitfire, you know, in their mansion in England, which they were using, I think it was called Falsworth Manor, the headquarters that the Avengers were using in England at the time, stumbling upon this hat box. So now this begs the question, Billy, the Avengers must have the invaders must have some kind of a trophy room. And this was the trophy room that she was dusting. And because why else would they keep that hat? It must be like a trophy from, or a memento from their adventure, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, but the fact that Don Glut picked this weird way to tell the story, that's a little bit of a misstep for me. I mean, it could have just been a normal invaders mission, but obviously they didn't want Spitfire and Union Jack in the tale, and they were part of the issue at this, or a part of the series at this moment, so maybe that's a means of just getting the original defenders to have an adventure on their own, but for me it's completely unnecessary, the original invaders I should say. So some weird choices regarding the way the story was told and the plot. That's my only small misstep here. And then, so that's it for our Bronze Age Brilliance and Mighty Marvel missteps. Now, Billy, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back and we'll discuss something other than this Invaders issue. We'll do our normal segments, which we haven't done in quite a while, right? Because we've had a couple of specials episodes coming out. But we'll get right into our regular segments, listeners. So don't go away.
And now, Wink Wilkinson's Weird World with your host, Wink Wilkinson. Hi, everybody, it's Weird Wink Wilkinson laughing and scratching at you. How's everybody doing today? I got a little bit of a stiff neck. Let me just fix this up. Oh, that feels a lot better. Well, I got a great show for you today with some wonderful weird stuff. What are you doing here? What? Please, lady, don't. Put your clothes back on. It's Wink Wilkinson. You can't do this to me. What if your husband were to walk in? I'm right here, Wink. I'm sorry. I love your show, but I've got to kill you both with this machine gun. Oh, you got me! I feel so very weird.
All right, we're back with our next segment, which is Shop Talk. And this is the segment where we discuss what's been happening in our comic book lives of late. Sometimes we discuss new comics, but Billy and I don't really read a lot of new stuff, so normally it's just news of the industry and the creators and, you know, the cinematic universe and so forth. So, Billy, I'll let you start first. What have you got for our Shop Talk segment on this fine day?
So the one thing I wanted to talk about was I saw, and I was a bit disappointed to see Scott Derrickson being off of Doctor Strange 2. you know, in the Multiverse of Madness. That was really disappointing because I thought, you know, there were some parts of the first Doctor Strange movie I thought, I didn't really care for that, or it would have been, you know, could have been better if it was done a little differently. But overall, I liked what he did there. But I also got to say that I wasn't really super sad for too long because, you know, last I heard, and, you know, you try looking things up online, and I can't find anything official yet, but it looks like Sam Raimi, who is in, you know, those first three Spider-Man movies back in the early 2000s, is in talks to take over as director. So that really had me pumped because I like that guy.
Come
I like
on, Sam him Raimi. Dead, Evil Dead 2, even Drag Me to Hell. And his Spider-Man movies were great. I mean, they're my favorite Spider-Man movies. I don't care what anybody else says. I love Tom Holland, but those old Spider-Man movies, even Spider-Man 3, I enjoyed it. It was a mess, but it was such a glorious mess for me. But yeah, Spider-Man 1 and 2, and that's my holy grail for Spider-Man. So yeah, Sam Raimi, bring him in. I mean, I love Scott Derrickson too, Billy, but yeah, I'm a Sam Raimi fan first and foremost. I want him in. Hey, we might even see more cameo appearances of Bruce Campbell in the Doctor Strange universe.
You never know.
Can never have enough of the chin.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, that's, and to me, I'm looking forward to that movie too, because it doesn't seem like they're going to do a lot of rewrites or anything, you know, like they're going to just try to bring him in, and I'm sure he'll want to change a couple of things, but it looks like they're still going to try to just keep with, you know, the direction they were going in. And he can go in there and work his magic, and sounds good to me. I would love to see that, because I know he wouldn't sign on for it if, you know, he couldn't do some of the things he wants to do, or if he didn't think there wasn't already something strong there. So, you know, and hey, maybe he'll get more down the road too. You never know.
That's right. Okay, well, Billy, for my Shop Talk segment, it almost borders on get off my lawn, but not really. I'm going to keep it positive. What I'm going to be talking about is, you know, lately... I would say within the last 3 or 4 months, actually, if that can be counted as lately, some big-name creators, modern-day big-name creators, have taken to sort of attacking other creators that they don't know, you know, based off of, you know, the creator's work and, you know, whether they like it or not. Now, I'm not talking about the Comicsgate movement here. I'm talking about guys who are not associated with Comicsgate. The first example was Rob Liefeld attacking the new X-Men comics helmed by Jonathan Hickman. And that was quite disturbing because, you know, I like Rob Liefeld as a guy, he's sometimes very arrogant. He's sometimes very in your face, but I really like the guy. He's very passionate about comics and stuff like that. The only thing is, though, he went off on a rant about, you know, Jonathan Hickman and how Jonathan Hickman's X-Men is not as good as the classic Byrne, Claremont X-Men. And, you know, but I thought that was just unnecessary. But since I wasn't very close to the material, I mean, I did love Hickman's X-Men. I didn't really pay attention to it that much. But recently, I think in January, Kurt Busiek, you know, great writer. I love him. I love his Conan stuff for Dark Horse. Obviously, he did Kingdom Come. You know, he started to diss Gardner Fox. He said Gardner Fox is like the worst writer, a horrible writer. Stop, you know, praising Gardner Fox. And I was thinking, this is the craziest thing ever. Yeah, of course, the guys who wrote in the Golden Age and the Silver Age, they didn't write the same as these, you know, postmodern writers, you know, like Busiek, Alan Moore, and all of that. But they don't have to. I mean, I can read a Jerry Siegel comic from the Silver Age, Legion of Superheroes, or whatever, you know, and I can still enjoy it because the stories are so out there, so crazy, so creative. Now, if you think about Kurt Busiek, I mean, yeah, he might be able to say that Gardner Fox is a bad writer, but I mean, he can't challenge the contributions Fox has made to DC. Gardner Fox came up with so many DC characters, if you think about it, Billy. And Kurt Busiek has just been basically rewriting those characters. Sure, he came up with a lot of characters in Astro City, but they're all derived from the classic superheroes. Not all, but most of them, that Gardner Fox created and that the people at Marvel created and that, you know, the other folks at DC created in the golden and silver ages of comics. So I don't see why he wants to attack. I mean, then you could say that he will attack everybody from Jerry Siegel to Stan Lee to, you know, basically every Golden and Silver Age writer.
Yeah.
And Gardner Fox, I've read a ton of Gardner Fox. His stories are not that bad. His later stuff, yeah. You know, in the 70s and 80s, I wouldn't call it bad, but I would call it that he lost touch with the zeitgeist of the time. But at least the earlier, you know, things written in the Golden and Silver Age, that was fantastic for me. I mean, it's not the greatest thing, greatest writer or writing ever, but, you know, the concepts introduced, the creativity behind it, I think the guy was a marvel. So why Kurt Busiek, why, you know, guys like Rob Liefeld chose to attack these guys who is part of the legacy that they share in, I don't understand it. And I just want to say that I don't agree with it, and I hope that people become more positive, and there's room for everybody, especially the legends that created the comic book field we love, that created the comic book universes we love. So, yeah. You know, I don't know how you feel about that, Billy.
Well, I mean, the Rob Liefeld thing doesn't bother me anywhere near as bad, because if Hickman has a problem with something Liefeld's saying, he can confront him about it, or he can say, this is what I feel about it. But Busiek going after Gardner Fox, somebody that can't even defend himself because he passed away many years ago,
yeah.
That really bothers me. And I just think to myself, look, man, even if you didn't care for the writing of some of the people that came before you, in some way, shape, or form, like you said, with creating characters and powers and things like that, you're standing on the shoulders of people like that. So it just, you know, he's a very arrogant guy. Like, I'm not a huge, like, Kurt Busiek, I enjoyed his Avengers that he did in the, what was that, late 90s when he started that?
George Perez, right? He did
some of the I enjoy that. Mm. A lot of people, like, you know, worship it like it's great. I don't think it's great. I think it's good, not great. Mm. I haven't read Astro City, but from what I've read of his work, I don't think he's any better or worse than Gardner Fox. So to kind of trample on somebody's work, especially after they've passed away, to me is it's pretty low.
No, I agree with you. I mean, if I look at who I would rather keep, you know, if I had to pick between the two, who I would rather keep as a part of comic books in general, I would definitely pick Gardner Fox 100%. Yeah. I mean, Kurt Busiek, he's a great writer, but he doesn't occupy that esteem. And the fact that he's trying to, you know, sort of challenge the fact that Gardner Fox is a legend, that is really, really upsetting to me. But anyway, so a bit of shop talk there, that's get off my lawn mixed with shop talk listeners. So, yeah. But let us know what you think, our weird listeners. Send some feedback to us and tell us about what you think about this recent disturbing trend among some modern comic creators to criticize the guys, the greats from the past, and even, you know, the modern comics that they don't seem to like because it doesn't conform to their standards.
Yeah, I know the one thing I totally forgot that he did, Avengers Forever.
Oh, yeah, that was pretty good.
Mm. And it was brilliant. And I even, I think at some point on social media, I even reached out to him and said, hey, you know, thank you for that. It was brilliant. And not to take anything away from him, but I did find out later on that Roger Stern and a couple other people were huge in helping him put that together.
Okay.
With all the information, you know, and getting everything right with the timeline and stuff like that. He had a lot of help with that. And, you know, I don't know about you, Herman, but like when I read comics, you know, especially years ago, I just read them, you know, for escapism. I didn't look into the history. I can be honest with you. The first few comics I read, I couldn't have even told you who wrote them or drew them. That didn't matter to me. You know, I was just reading characters, just like I said, for escapism and enjoyment and entertainment. Mm. And then, you know, as I've gotten a little bit older, I kind of look into things like, well, who wrote this and drew this? And I, you know, gotten a bit in, more into the history of comics. And like I said, I found out he had a tremendous amount of help with that. So, you know, not to take anything away from him, but, you know, one of the things I do, like, that's probably the highest on my Kurt Busiek list, you know, is something that wasn't wholly his. So, you know.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Well, this makes for an interesting aside, Billy, because if we can go off on a quick tangent here, you know, I also didn't get into, like you mentioned, reading about the history and stuff of the creators and the comic books until maybe the 1990s when Wizard Magazine started publishing stuff. Now, Wizard Magazine not my favorite publication by a long shot, but sometimes they did focus on the history of comics. And I remember liking those articles. You know, I would sporadically buy Wizard, and that got me into wondering, you know, what came before and how did these guys, what were their lives like? But, you know, when I was a kid, just like you, I didn't read, you know, I wasn't interested in the lives of the creators and, you know, their history so much. That came, you know, recently, within the last decade or so. You know, I've been researching a lot of those guys. But yeah, good point. Why do we read comics? Is to immerse ourselves in fantasy worlds and things that, you know, entertain us. But, you know, doing a podcast or talking to friends, sometimes it's interesting to discover the lives of these folks who created it. But I don't think your average kid, you know, he's definitely not that into that, you know, side of comics. But you're right. I mean, obviously, now that we know, you know, the legacy Gardner Fox left behind, people like him, and if we compare that to Kurt Busiek and what he's done, I don't know. There's just no comparison for me.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, good point. But okay, listeners, that's it for Shop Talk. We're heading into the end game of the podcast here. And our next segment will be the recommendations of Ragador.
Once again, it falls upon the shoulders of the Dread Dormammu to deliver the recommendations of Ragador to your impatient ears, you insignificant human trash. If it wasn't for the bet I lost against Stephen Strange, forcing me to submit to his fawning cronies, you'd all be choking on flames at this very moment. As it is, the media chosen by my pop culture-obsessed peer, Ragador, or Rags, as I like to call him once we've both had a few flagons of Sidorak grog, meets with my approval. After all, it involves that which you humans are so very good at, war, and exterminating yourselves. Oh, you monkeys make my job that much easier. But don't go setting off any doomsday devices yet. Wait, just a little while longer. And when my tenure is done, I'll join the fray. Soon, insects. Soon.
Okay, we're back with the recommendations of Ragador. All right, Billy, as ever, I'm going to let you go first. This is your segment, the one that you founded, and probably one of my favorite segments. Take it away for your recommendations of Ragador.
Okay, so, you know, dipping into the World War II basket here, you know, since we talked about that with our Invader story, I have to recommend this story. And you and I have talked about it before, and one day, I'm saying it right now, we will talk about this book. It's called I Am Legion by Humanoids. You know this one, don't you, Herman?
Yes, yes. Sorry, yeah, I do know it. I do know it. I've got it somewhere here.
Oh, yeah.
It's been ages since I've read it, though. But yeah.
Yeah, it's written by a guy named Fabian Nuri, and I don't know that I've ever read anything else by him. And then the art is by John Cassaday, who, you know, we all know him. Brilliant artist. So it's a World War II story, but it involves vampires. And there's a lot of, you know, regular kind of tropes to it, but then there's a lot of different stuff that Nuri brings into it. But, oh, it's an insane story, World War II, you know. I'm not sure if that came out as an OGN or if it, I think it might have come out as singles, didn't it? And they collected it maybe?
Yeah, no. It came out as singles and they collected it, I think, 3 volumes, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, but I bought them digitally though, Billy, so I'm not quite sure, but yeah. I think I've got the digital one here. I remember loving it because it, like you say, it's World War II, it's Nazis experimenting on people, vampirism, and it reminds me of the recent movie Overlord. I don't know if you've seen that.
Oh no, I haven't seen
but
that.
But that's during the same time that I discovered this series. So tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean this is one that says it's a World War II story, and the plot is Nazis seek to capture and control a 10-year-old girl that's a vampire. And then, you know, the Allied forces, of course, are trying to uncover that Nazis have infiltrated their ranks, and then, you know, halfway through it, figure out like there's something, you know, crazy going on with the vampires, and trying to figure out how to combat that as well. It's just, it's, oh my goodness. You will, there's nobody, I mean, it's dense. It's a very dense book.
Yeah.
So, you know, you set aside some time, but it's like 150 pages probably, you know, but it's very good. You'll love it.
Yeah. No. I mean, I remember it when I first started reading it. I don't know when it was, but it was a while back. You know, the Humanoids publishing, they don't really do single issues, Billy. They do these volumes, right? Volume one, mm-hmm. volume two, volume three. So you could count them as single issues, though, but they're dense. They're usually 40 or even 60-page comics. So you're right. They published it as singles, if you look at the volumes like that. But then for the American market, I think it was collected in a hardcover and maybe even in a paperback. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But like I say, I read it digitally. And, you know, you can just buy the whole collection digitally. And, wow, yeah, this is a... I mean, John Cassidy, this is when he was still really, really good. He's still good now, but I think he was great during this time when he was also doing Astonishing X-Men with Josh Whedon. This was his heyday. And, wow, this is a story of horror and great World War II setting as well. So, that's a great recommendation from you, Billy. For me, I'm not going to go comics, but also related to the war, Billy. My dad, he's a huge World War II buff. So while I was visiting him in Australia, we decided to see a movie together. And we went for Midway, the new World War II movie that was on the circuit. It's probably off circuit by now, but I wasn't thinking that they would do anything great with the source material. I was expecting 1917, the other movie about World War One that was running concurrently to be better, and it was also really great. But Midway turned out to be my favorite of the two. It was really well based, set in reality. You know, they didn't exaggerate anything, much like the movie Pearl Harbor did with Ben Affleck and Josh Hartnett, 20 years ago. That was just crazy. But, you know, this one stuck to the reality pretty much based off of what I know of World War II history, mostly from my dad. And, you know, just watching that with my dad and seeing him enjoying it so much, that was a real thrill for me. And I would recommend this movie. It's filled with incredible action, brilliant special effects, but not, you know, it doesn't look like special effects. It looks completely real. And it's epic. It's on an epic scale. It takes in the perspective from the Japanese side and from the British, from the American side. So it's definitely not biased, if you know what I mean. There are the good Japanese who didn't want Pearl Harbor to happen, and they didn't want, you know, what eventually happened in the Pacific to happen. And then there were the bad Japanese, and then there were the Americans, who were basically all good, but they're also the guys who made mistakes. You know, the admirals and stuff like that. They focus on human fallibility in this series, in this movie, I should say. So, brilliant. Yeah. Lots of listeners have probably already seen it, but if you're into World War II, Midway is a definite must, and you must see it. And then, Billy, are you interested in that? Would you be up for watching Midway?
That sounds good. Yeah, that sounds really good. I love those. And then I haven't seen too much on that, but the other one, the 1917, I did see a trailer for that, and I was blown away. I thought, ooh, that looks real good.
Oh, that was really good, Billy. Man, trench warfare at its finest, brutal, bloody, also a favorite of mine. I would probably give Midway, I would give an 8 out of 10, and 1917 just slightly lower, 7.5 out of 10. Still
cool.
Very, very high ratings for me. So watch that, listeners, if you're of a mind to take in some World War II action, and World War One in terms of 1917. But then, Billy, just a quick other recommendation. I didn't read too much when I was in Australia. We were basically running around a lot and doing lots of outdoor stuff. But I did manage to read something that I took along. And this was a comic book that had recently been collected again. So for the listeners who want to pick it up, you could probably pick it up in the comic book stores at the moment or in Amazon. And this was Peter Milligan and Mike Allred's Ecstatics. Now, I don't know if you ever read that, Billy, but that was in the late 1990s, coming off of X-Force, you know, where the X-Force basically devolved into this kind of TV show-esque popular superhero TV show, which, I mean, this is not a real TV show. This is in the comic, though. The members of X-Force became these mutants who were reality stars, reality show stars, and they, you know, were constantly followed around by cameras, and the media was interested in their exploits, and they were doing superheroing for fame. They weren't really superheroes. So X-Statics is a series that sort of bled off of the X-Force title when it was canceled. But, you know, I love the art of Mike Allred. I'm a huge Allred mark. I loved his Madman series that he did before starting to work for Marvel, and I'm loving everything he's doing for DC and beyond, and the Silver Surfer series he recently did. So I love that kind of art that he's this kind of pop art that his panels usually look like. And this series, I forgot how great it was. I mean, Peter Milligan, obviously a British writer coming off of 2000 AD, I read him when he was still doing work for in Britain. And I knew the guy, and I followed him to the American market, and that's how I started reading X-Statics. It wasn't because I was particularly an X-Force fan at that point in time. It was just because of Milligan. And then I was pleasantly surprised to see they had Allred on for the ride. Now, I would recommend this collection, because that's the way I reread it in, which is X-Statics Volume 1, and that collects the final arc of X-Force right before the series was canceled. This is X-Force Volume 1. And then it also collects the first five issues of X-Statics, the new series. And it's a great read. Most of our listeners might have already read it, but I would recommend it again in this collection, particularly. You know, it's a nice, sturdy paperback, similar to the Marvel Epic collections. And great color. No recoloring, but, you know, the colors are very vibrant and really highlighting Allred's art. And then the writing by Milligan is just zany and ridiculously fun. It's, you know, focusing on these flawed superheroes who are only in it for the fame and for the celebrity points, and it's just fun. It's just a great series. I would recommend that from the late 1990s, early 2000s. So check that out. X-Statics Volume 1, the complete collection. That's what it's called.
Yeah, Mike Allred, to me, he's one of the few like newer artists that he's really set himself apart from the pack with his unique style, big time.
Definitely. No, I would agree with that. He's so eclectic that it borders on an almost, you know, above comic book art. You could see him doing like an Andy Warhol type show, but focused only on comics. That's how good he is. And also his wife, Laura Allred, also has to take some credit for it. You know, she normally colors and inks and stuff and helps him out.
But
basically Mike Allred, he's a force, one of the greats. I'm ranking him right up there with guys like Darwin Cook, and, you know, Darwin Cook has passed, but I mean his art's very not similar, but in I discovered them both at the same time, and Darwin Cook on New Frontier, and Mike Allred and Darwin Cook for me is like way up there, on the same level, and that's saying a lot because Darwin Cook's a legend. So yeah, well, we'll see lots more from Mike, though. He's still a relatively young guy. He's got a lot of comics left in him.
And absolutely. I'm
looking forward to everything he does. But listeners, that brings us to the end of our recommendations of Ragador. We're going to end the show with a quick foray into our listener feedback, which I will handle. And then I will also ascribe a superior moniker to a listener who gave us a 5-star iTunes review. But we're going to play a quick promo, and then we'll be back with that segment of the show.
Batman Nightcast, a thrilling new podcast from the Fire and Water Podcast Network, hosted by Ryan Daly
and Chris Franklin. Nightcast chronicles the Caped Crusaders' adventures in Batman and Detective Comics after Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Highlights from this legendary era include
Batman number 400,
Legends,
Mike Barr and Alan Davis,
Batman Year 1,
Batman Year 2,
Max Allen Collins, the new Jason Todd, Millennium?
You're not doing this right. Let me take over. Alan Grant and Norm Brayfogle.
Alan Grant from Jurassic Park?
Did you hear me say Norm freaking Breyfogle?
Oh, yeah.
Son of the Demon.
The Killing Joke.
A Death in the Family.
Batman Year 3.
A Lonely Place of Dying.
Alan Grant, Alan Davis, Max Allan Collins. Why are there so many people named Alan from this era of Batman?
The Rise of Tim Drake.
Legends of the Dark Knight.
And that's just up until 1989.
Did anything exciting happen with Batman after that?
You'll have to tune in to find out.
Batman Nightcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Find it on iTunes and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Oh, we forgot to mention your favorite issue, when Batman fires Dick Grayson.
You want to find another co-host?
Time for our Allies of Agamotto segment. At first, I want to give a big thank you to Ryan Daly, who wrote us a 5-star iTunes review. Thanks a lot, Ryan. I really appreciate it. Because of that, you qualify for an alter ego. Yes, that's right. We're giving you a Bronze Age alter ego specifically designed for you based on your likes and dislikes. I specifically referenced your love for the Submariner in coming up with this origin. And I also looked a little bit at the other podcasts you did, the Secret Origins podcast, the Batman Nightcast, the promo of which I just played. I also added a smattering of horror, since you're doing the Midnight, the Podcasting Hour show, which is one of my favorites, and that was how I was introduced to you on the Fire and Water Network. So there's going to be some horror in here, there's going to be some Marvel Submariner tropes, and there's also going to be a little bit of DC. Why not? It's got a bit of a DC flavor. So first, before I ascribe you this alter ego, I'm going to read the review you wrote for us. All right, Ryan wrote this review on the 24th of September of 2019. He said, celebrating Marvel's weird age, in the 1960s, Marvel Comics redefined the superhero genre by introducing the Fantastic Four, the Avengers, and the Amazing Spider-Man. In the 70s, however, they delved into the darker corners of visual storytelling that weren't so mainstream. It was a renaissance for head-tripping cosmic adventures and hair-raising horror tales, for street-talking, blaxploitation, and fist-flying martial arts action. Into the Weird embraces this era of Marvel history, shining the spotlight on the stories and characters that occupy the nebulous gray area between the time superheroes and classic literary monsters came together. This is the realm of Doctor Strange, Master of the Mystique Arts, as well as the macabre muck monster Man-Thing, the flaming motorcyclist Ghost Rider, the living vampire Morbius, the cyborg soldier Deathlok, and so much more delicious Marvel weirdness. The hosts, Herman and Grant, later replaced by Billy, clearly love this content, and who can blame them? This is some of Marvel's most fun material in its craziest decade. The guys are always in sync with each other, even when the show changes co-hosts. They don't miss a beat. The joy in these reviews is as evident as the madness in these comics. Give this podcast a listen. You'll enjoy it. That's one of our best reviews ever. Thanks again, Ryan, or should I say thanks, Count Druncula, which is Ryan's iTunes moniker, which he uses to write reviews under. Count Druncula, probably one of the better names out there. All right, Ryan, so without further ado, here we go. This is what I came up with. The presentation of the following Secret Origin is co-sponsored by the Into the Weird podcast, Miskatonic University's Department of Cryptid Pseudo-Archaeology, and select members of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, who shall remain nameless so as not to incite Ryan's ire, but who nevertheless feel it is time for the world to be made aware of Ryan's truly inhuman nature. This origin is therefore offered as a public service. In the sunken city of Mu, deep beneath the Pacific Ocean, strange beings cavort and glide through hidden ocean currents, feeding off the leviathans of the deep like parasitic viperfish, drunk on blood, arcane power, and forbidden rituals. Once these beings were Nosferatu, roaming the surface world, supping the blood of pre-cataclysmic humanity, but were cast down into the ocean depths by the sorcerous Atlanteans and demonic Lemurians. Through the magic of its enemies, the dark city of Mu, crashed beneath the waves in a mighty cataclysm. Yet still, its denizens survived and thrived, adapting to the lightless depths cast upon the mercy of evolution. Their bodies morphed over vast spans of time and came to resemble forms more manta ray than man. And this is where our story begins. Born out of wedlock to a princess of Mu, young Rai An was the subject of mockery from an early age due to his human-like appearance. Once the scandal broke that his father was in fact a human from one of the Mu zoological air pocket exhibits, Ryan's everyday life became a living hell. No matter that his natural aquatic and vampiric abilities were far superior to those of his peers due to his hybrid nature, still he was hounded and persecuted. Finally, a hate crime determined his destiny. Both his mother and father were found slain on the outskirts of the city, his mother having tried in vain to free her beloved from captivity. The breathing apparatus and pressure garb she stole for her lover was faulty and needed constant maintenance, slowing the couple down as they made their bid for freedom. This allowed their murderers to easily overtake them and to perpetrate the vile deed. The murder of his parents and the unwillingness of the royal family to prosecute those responsible caused Rai An to declare monstrous injustice his lifelong enemy. He decided to leave the hidden depths of Mu for the surface world, where he might learn more of his father's people and be accepted for his human-like appearance. But first, he used his natural intelligence and inborn detective skills to track down the killers and made an example of them. Eventually reaching the surface world, his first sight of the alien fauna that awaited him was the shape of a bat flitting across the pale disk of the moon on a secluded beach where he had exited his erstwhile home. Cowering in terror from this hideous flapping creature, Rai An mastered his fear and resolved then and there that he would never again feel that horrid emotion. Rather, he would inspire it in the breasts of those who served injustice and hate. He would become a symbol of fear. He would become... Well, at that moment in time, he did not know just what he would exactly become. But as an aquatic vampire subject to the whims of nature, he did know that it was time for a snack. Strolling down the beach, he soon encountered an unfortunate band of hippies, stoned out of their minds, contorting themselves in weird convolutions around a bonfire. Their unwashed bodies and offensive clothes served as no protection against the hunger of Rai An. After the feast, as he was wiping gory blood off his lips, and the cape-like fronds of his great manta fins that flowed from his arms like wings, he recalled what the hippies had screamed moments before taking their final breaths. One addled youth had shouted, "Hey man, it's like some huge manta ray walking on 2 feet. Another dark-skinned dreadlock-sporting musician had said, "No, you tripping dog, that's the superhero Stingray back from the dead, yo." The vacant-eyed girl was next.
"Get out of here. It's more like a soaking wet bat. Shit!"
At last, Rai An knew what he would become. The answer came unbidden to his mind. He would become the scourge of the unjust, the ravager of the intolerant. He would become Bat-Manta. But first, his bloodlust. Far from sated by watered-down heapy blood, he still needed some dessert. After all, there was another party further down the beach, the members of which were sporting tiki torches, chanting offensively. With a grim smile and a greater hunger rumbling in his belly, Bat Manta sauntered down the beach to make their acquaintance. And that's it, Ryan, your Bronze Age alter ego. Hopefully you dig it. Let me know. I'll send you the timestamp, as I want to do with everybody who gets an alter ego. All right, listeners, that's it for our Bronze Age alter ego presentation. I also want to thank some folks, especially Chase Grafton, who reached out to us and corrected our error that I mentioned earlier on the show, where I mentioned that you could find the Doctor Strange story we discussed in episode 16 in the trade paperback, A Separate Reality. Doctor Strange, A Separate Reality. Thank you for that, Chase. And then we also got some new iTunes reviews. One we got from Cathode Ray Phantom and one from the aforementioned Chase Grafton himself. And we also got an iTunes review from someone called Cubon Nature Trainer Lannister Fan. Thanks, guys, for those reviews. And thanks to all of the folks on Twitter, all of our friends who liked and retweeted our last post about the show, about episode 16. We really appreciate all of you and all the interactions we have with you daily. And it's really something that Billy and I both enjoy. And we're deeply grateful for all of you folks who listen to the show. And we appreciate that. So thank you to the allies of Agamotto. All right, that's it for another episode of Into the Weird. We'll leave you listeners with our details and where you could leave feedback and where you can find us on socials. Billy, we'll start with you. Where can the listeners track you down if they're in the mind for some light stalking?
Yeah, definitely look me up on Twitter for sure, at BillyD_Licious. And then if you're a Facebooker, go to Magazines and Monsters, my Facebook page on there, and a blog by the same name, magazinesandmonsters.com.
That's right. And for me, listeners, you can find me at Dark Longbox on Twitter. And also our main Twitter account for Into the Weird is at Into Weird. Billy and I are there daily. I wasn't there a lot, you know, while I was in Australia, but, you know, now I'm getting back into the Twitterverse. And a lot of posts that I need to catch up on. A lot of great threads that I missed. Damn it. And then please also check out our website, which is www.sinkintotheweird.com. That's sinkintotheweird.com. You can also send feedback. We'd love some feedback, especially voice files, to sinkintotheweird@gmail.com. And then please check out The Long Box of Darkness, our sister, my sister podcast related to Into the Weird, which is a horror-focused comic podcast, which you can find, just Google or check on your podcast feed for Long Box of Darkness. And then that also has a website, darklongbox.com, or I should say longboxofdarkness.com. And yeah, send feedback to darklongbox@gmail.com if you're of a mind to do that. We'll also play that on Into the Weird, since the shows are now connected, right, Billy?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
They're inseparable. All right, so listeners, that's it for today. But we'll be back, like I say, more consistently from now on. We'll leave you with a short message. Take care of yourselves and don't repeat the horrors of war. Don't rob the graves and, you know, create a patchwork monster to promote your views of, you know, the super race. Just and stay away from those Japanese girls who are intent upon transplanting your brain into a more attractive, you know, body. I'm not saying all Japanese girls are like that. No, not at all. In fact, Japanese
only
girls
Kitty.
Are... Oh, yeah, only Kitty. Kitty. I mean, I've actually got a thing for Japanese girls. Don't tell Erin that. She's the closest I could come. She's Chinese, so... No, I'm kidding. So, listeners, yeah, we'll see you. Stay weird and join us again for another episode in a couple of weeks' time. And once again, we'll all sink together into the weird. Bye-bye.